I first met Bill Phillips about 11 years ago. I was a brand new graduate student at the University of Wisconsin, and Bill had come to Madison to give a talk. And in those days, using lasers to make atoms cold was really big news, and in the atomic physics world, it was almost a revolution. Everybody thought they knew how you could use light to cool down atoms, as all of you former and present Physical Science 100 students know. Motion is defined as temperature, as heat. And if you make an atom slow down, then you make it cold. Well, if you shine light onto an atom, it will bounce off and give the atom a tiny push. And if you push your atom in exactly the right way, you can slow it down, and you can almost bring it to rest. Well, that was the half of the story. Bill's work actually showed that the ideas behind laser cooling were much more subtle, and the results were much more dramatic than anybody had really ever expected. And you're all invited to hear the rest of that story tonight at 7:30 in the JSB auditorium while Bill Phillips will be doing liquid nitrogen and fire and smoke and men being chopped in half and women fainting and children crying and... or maybe not, but it will be a free date, so you're all invited to come at 7:30 in the JSB auditorium. Yeah. So I sat there listening to Bill. He was stars in my eyes. He was everything that a young, aspiring graduate student hoped to be. He was famous. He was a fabulous speaker. He had all the best toys for doing his research. He got paid for doing his hobby. And I just thought, gee, you know, how could I be like that? And a few years later, I ended up working for him in his lab. And I learned that Bill was all of these things, of course, and more. Bill was born in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. He attended college at Juniata College, which is a small religious school. He earned his PhD from the MIT and received the Wiseman Fellowship there for postdoctoral studies and stayed for 2 more years. He eventually moved to the National Bureau of Standards, where he's been ever since. He's published a gazillion articles. He shared in the 1997 Nobel Prize in Physics for his work in laser cooling. He leads one of the largest and most productive atomic physics research groups in the world. He's a member of the National Academy of Science and, you know, fill in the blank, blank, blank. But I don't think that Bill really cares about any of it. He jokes that when he got the Nobel Prize in Physics, everybody said, "Hey, I should have won it for that," because it was a big field. I think that if none of this had happened, if fame had completely passed Bill Phillips by, he would be fundamentally the same person. He's a deeply religious person, active in his faith, committed to his family, engaged in all kinds of Christian service, and a wonderful example for all of us. Please join me in welcoming Bill Phillips.
Well, thanks, Scott, for that lovely introduction. I do want to correct one thing. The children don't cry. They love the thing. So if you've got kids, they'll love it too. So do come. You know, I'm kind of surprised to find myself here. After all, what is a physicist doing giving the forum at BYU? Until about 4 years ago, nobody was interested in my views about religion, except maybe the 100 or so people that go to my church. Fewer still were interested in my views about science and religion. And here I am. How did this come about? Well, a little more than 4 years ago, I was attending a meeting in Long Beach, California. And in the middle of the night, I got a call from Stockholm. And later that morning, they held a press conference to note the event. And I got a little clip of that press conference, and it'll show you how it all got started. Okay, so this is somebody introducing me.
Arthur Schallow from Stanford University won the prize in 1981 for the development of laser spectroscopy. Robert Earle from Rice University won the prize just last year for the discovery of fullerenes. And here directly on my left is this year's victim, William D. Phillips from the National Institutes of Standard and Technology, who won the prize for the development of methods to cool and trap atoms using laser light. Bill?
Well, that was the first time I'd heard myself referred to as a victim for the Nobel Prize, but the significance of that became more and more clear to me as time went on. Now, also, I did a lot of smiling that day, and I think I didn't stop smiling for about 3 days. I never imagined that this was going to happen.
This is really incredible for me. I never imagined that this was going to happen. It's just such an indescribable thrill for me to be able to join the company of people like Bart and Rob. It's hard to know what to say. Well, one of the things I want to do is to thank a lot of people. To begin with, I think that God has given us an incredibly fascinating world to live in and to explore, and I'm really thankful that I've had a chance to explore a little bit of that and to have a great deal of fun doing it.
Okay, so that was what started it all. That rather innocent statement on my part got me branded as the religious laureate. And so people started asking me about my views on science and religion, even though I didn't know anything about science and religion. I had never studied the topic. I hadn't developed very clear ideas about it. But one of the problems with the Nobel Prize is that people all of a sudden think that you know something about everything. Now, I know a lot about laser cooling, but I didn't know much about science and religion. And what you have to do is understand that even though people think you know something about everything, that in fact you don't. But people kept asking me about these things, and so, for example, a television crew from Sweden came to the United States. They wanted to film me in my laboratory, in my home, and in my church. And here's a little clip from Swedish television that was picked up by CNN.
The religious faith that Bill Phillips celebrates at his church is also part of his scientific work.
Choir practice.
I believe that God has given us a natural world that is full of wonder and full of exciting possibilities to explore. And I really believe that God rejoices with us when we discover something new about the world he's created. And I believe he created such an interesting world so that we could have fun.
Well, in Sweden, the Nobel Prizes are a kind of a mixture of the Academy Awards and the Super Bowl. In other words, it's a really big deal. So they have these interviews with all of the Nobel laureates. They're showing them on television weeks before. It's like up close and personal with the Nobel laureates. So continuing to the day of the ceremonies, which are televised live all throughout the country, the ceremony, the banquet, the ball afterwards, just before the ceremony, the Swedish television ran a clip from the same time. So it's a little different what Swedish television decided to show as compared to CNN. Now, if any of you speak Swedish, maybe you can tell me what this guy is saying.
Bill Phillips.
That part I could understand.
Han älskar ju sina linser, och med dem så fokuserar han också sina laserstrålar.
Men jag träffade honom i en helt annan film, utanför Fairhaven
i hans hemstad.
Fairhaven, that's my church, Washington, United
Methodist
DC, Church.
I en metodistkyrka.
Same song.
Sunday morning is the most segregated time of the week in the United States, that where blacks and whites often are together in the workplace and in other other places, that in houses of worship, that very often we don't have blacks and whites together. So our church is very special in that way, and the history of the joining of these three churches, more out of necessity, I think, because of the fact that they were too small to survive on their own, but has given us a great blessing to join together people from different backgrounds from different ethnic and cultural backgrounds in this one church. As a child, I was in churches that were all white. I never heard the kind of music that I now sing. So for me, it was a wonderful thing first to be able to hear the kind of music, the style in which music from the black tradition is sung, but then to be allowed to become part of the choir to sing this music for me is just been a great joy.
Favorites. Anyway, so after this, there's the ceremony. Well, I'm not going to bore you with this, but you know, there's 1,800 people in the concert hall in Sweden. They've got a full concert orchestra. Well, anyway, let me just show you the most important thing is that when the laureates march in, the physicists come in first, because physics is the most important thing. It's because Nobel mentioned physics in his will first, so the physics is always first. So here come the physicists. I'm the third one in line. Well, anyway, so there was... that was the wrong way. Okay, there we go. So after that, chemistry... okay, so, you know, we have to get up and go and... I was so nervous. I was so glad.
I ask you to step forward.
Alphabetical order. That meant Chu went first, which was a good thing because I was so nervous. I wanted to, you know, get a chance to see how everybody else did it. So, well, anyway, let's... okay, so you get the prize, you bow to the king, you bow to the academy, you bow to the audience. Claude Cohen-Tanucci from France seemed to just have that European savoir-faire. He knew just what to do. I was just so nervous. I was afraid I was going to drop the stuff on the king's toe, you know? It was, I just, extra bows, make sure I didn't forget anybody. You know, there's my family, my sister-in-law, my daughters, my wife. It was a really, really incredible thing. Remember, they've got a concert orchestra there. They got a world-class soprano, so they're gonna. It was everything. Afterwards, there's a banquet. We're gonna see a little bit of that. Okay, so there's a banquet, a procession. Okay, the king comes in, the queen. I'm right behind the princesses. These are two princesses. And now the woman in the orange dress is my partner. She's the Speaker of the Parliament. So the physicists come in, like, right behind the royalty. And when it comes to sit down, I sit with the queen. And she's thinking right now, why does it always have to be a physicist? Well, anyway, so after the banquet, there's more interviews, and people are still interested for reasons that are still sort of escaping me in my views on science and religion. So here's one of those interviews. This is like the Connie Chung of Sweden.
You are a religious man.
Well, I like to describe myself as a person who has faith.
Yes, very good.
I don't think she understood there was any distinction there, because she didn't bother translating that for her Swedish audience.
Still a conflict between religion and science?
Well,
I'm not sure if you heard this. She asked me, what about the conflict between religion and science? This always seems to be the focus of what people want to talk about.
Don't find a conflict. I know that some people see conflicts, but for me, I see the lessons of religion telling us about how we should live our lives in relationship to other people. And I see the lessons of science telling us the way in which God has constructed our universe. So I don't see a conflict between the two areas.
After all, there is a conflict.
Okay, so now she's going to explain that in Swedish to the audience. Well, I can probably imagine all sorts of better answers that I could have given, but the point that I want to make is that this seems to be the focus of a lot of people's questions, is what about the conflict between science and religion? How do you reconcile science and religion? It makes me think of an incident that happened some years ago when my older daughter was in high school, and she was having a conversation with one of her good friends. And the friend said, well, my mother is a scientist, so of course she's an atheist. And my daughter said, you can't walk across the fellowship hall of our church without tripping over six physicists. And this misconception, which seems to be very prevalent in the public and even among lots of scientists, is something that I think needs to be addressed, and people need to stand up and say, no, this is not a problem. So if there's nothing else that you remember from what I'm telling you this morning, here is the basic message, that an ordinary scientist with ordinary religious faith is nothing unusual. I'm a physicist. I study how the universe works. I see in that universe beauty, order, simplicity. I see everything played out according to a few simple rules. When I look at all that, it is very difficult for me and very difficult for many scientists to escape the conclusion that an intelligent creator is behind all of this. Now, does that make my belief in God scientific? No, it doesn't, and I'll explain that in a moment. But neither does it make my belief in God irrational. My belief in God is completely consistent with, I believe, everything that I know about science. But it's not based on science. Why do I say that? Scientific statements are falsifiable. That means if I make a scientific statement, I can also tell you what kind of an experiment you could do, where if the outcome turned out a certain way, I would then have to give up believing in that statement. So, for example, let's say that I say that plants need light to grow. Well, then I can tell you, well, what you do is you take the plant, you put it in the dark, and if it grows, then I'm wrong. Okay? So, when you take some green leafy plant and put it in the dark and it doesn't grow, then I say, well, gee, that's good. You haven't proved me wrong. And then when you finally take a mushroom and put it in the dark and it grows, I say, oh, well, I guess that was wrong. We're going to have to refine the statement. And then I'll say, well, green plants need light to grow. And if you keep doing that kind of thing, that's science. And you learn all about photosynthesis and how green plants work. But the point is that if you're going to make a scientific statement, it has to be coupled with some kind of an understanding of what you would do to show that that statement is false. Now, if I say God created the heavens and the earth, I can't tell you anything that you're going to do that if it turned out a certain way, that I would cease to believe that that was so. And that's why I say that my belief is not scientific. But it's absolutely rational. Let me play you another tape. Oh, actually, this isn't the tape I wanted to show. This is Brazilian television.
That a lot of people find it difficult to reconcile the understandings of science and the insights of faith. But I guess it's just a matter of how you approach it.
Wouldn't it be great if in real life, whenever you said something, no matter how inane, that there were these lights from heaven that would come down and affirm, you know, what you had just said? Well, you know, through the magic of television editing, that can happen on apparently on Brazilian television. Well, anyway, let's fast forward this a little bit here. There's more of that. Yeah. So if you can read Portuguese, you know what I'm saying. Okay, this is... Okay,
yeah, we got it.
Okay, so let me explain what's going on here. This is a lecture given by Stephen Hawking at the White House. Now, I think most of you know that Stephen Hawking suffers from a neurological disease, and he cannot speak, and he cannot move anything except his right thumb. And with that, he can compose things on a computer, he can answer questions. But if someone asks him a question, it takes a few minutes before he can compose the answer. And so in order to avoid having any dead time on television, they planted a few scientists in the audience to answer questions that had been sent in by students beforehand. So this is me responding to one of those questions.
University of Maryland student Daniel Manilow, which I'd like to direct to Dr. William Phillips, 1997 Nobel laureate in physics. Dr. Phillips, why does the universe obey any laws at all?
Well, that's a really good question, and I really wish I had a really good answer for it. It's the kind of question that has intrigued and vexed scientists and, I suppose, philosophers and theologians for a long time. It's really quite remarkable. All of the wonderful things Professor Hawking talked about can actually be described in a very small number of relatively simple equations and then a lot of complicated mathematics. Why is it that the universe is so simple? Why is it that it follows mathematical laws? Well, people have speculated about this, and one possible answer is that if the universe had been any different from what it is, we wouldn't be here. That is, if the laws of the universe hadn't been what they are, or if there were no laws at all, it would have been impossible for life to have evolved. It would have been impossible for us to have evolved to the point that we could ask that question. So that's sometimes called the anthropic principle, not perhaps to put too much emphasis on people, but it probably applies to amoebas as well, that they wouldn't have been able to evolve either. On the other hand, there is another answer which isn't actually that far from that answer, and if you're a person with religious faith, as I am, you could answer that the reason we have a universe that follows laws is because God decided to make the universe in that way, because God wanted us to develop the way we have and to evolve in the way that we have, and that this is of course a philosophical and theological answer, and it has more to do with one's faith than one's scientific conclusions, but it's an answer that I like very much and that I don't find very different from the first one.
This idea about the anthropic principle is an illustration of how completely rational a belief in God is. The odds against having the universe that we have are absolutely astronomical, and most of the other universes that one could imagine, and there's no reason to believe that the universe couldn't have been different, most of the other universes one could imagine would never have even produced planets, let alone life. So why is it that we live in a universe that seems so remarkably fine-tuned for the development of life? If the amount of matter in the universe had been different by some incredibly tiny fraction, then stars never would have formed, and then planets would never have formed, and we never would have come into being. So why is it that we live in such a universe that seems so remarkably fine-tuned for life? Well, one answer is, well, what do you expect? Here we are. Of course we have to be in a universe like that. But that's not a very satisfying answer. A lot of people have come to the conclusion that a good answer to this is because God wanted it to be that way. Now, other people have come to different conclusions, and they've presented possible alternatives, that there are a gazillion other universes that are all doing something else and don't have any life in them, and we have no communication with those universes. Well, that appeals to some people, but it's an idea that's completely without any support scientifically. It's just an alternative idea. And so a lot of people, a lot of scientists, have decided that it makes perfect sense to believe in God. And many have come to the opposite conclusion. And some of these scientists have taken this orderliness of the universe, its design as a place that is suitable for life, its simplicity and its regularity as a kind of definition of God. God as a sort of cosmic intelligence. Sometimes people call this Einstein's God. Einstein affirmed a belief in a creative intelligence, but without personality and without will. Well, I believe in an intelligent creator, but I also believe in a personal God. A God who wants a personal relationship with each one of us. A God who infuses our lives with joy. A God who wants good things for us, and who wants us to love one another as he loves us. Why do I believe that? Where is the evidence? And the answer is, this is not a scientific belief. It's faith. What does the book of Hebrews say about faith? Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. That's the kind of evidence that I have for that kind of a belief in God. Faith is a way of knowing that is different from the way of science. The great physicist Freeman Dyson has said that science and religion look through different windows at the same reality. I love that image because in life we are always looking through different windows at the same life. We look at life through all kinds of different windows. When we appreciate art or music or food, we're not generally being scientific. The fact that I prefer French Impressionist painters to French Romantics is not something that I arrived at by a scientific procedure. That doesn't make this any less important to me than a scientific choice that I make, like preferring the kinetic theory of heat over the phlogiston theory. It's just different. And the fact is that I do not want to be scientific about my taste in art or music or food. How dull life would be for a scientist if he only looked at life through the window of science. Even the most highly trained biologist walking in the moonlight hand in hand with a beloved companion does not want to appreciate that experience through the window of biochemistry. A hard-nosed physicist who demands empirical evidence to back up any physical idea will not want to experience love using the scientific method. So if I, as a scientist, am willing and even eager to commit an important part of my life to something as non-scientific as love, then why should anyone be surprised that I'm willing to make a similarly unscientific commitment to God? You'll hear some people say, how can you believe in a personal God? Where is he? Where is the evidence that such a being exists and interacts with us? Even some theologians have concluded that in the age of science, a traditional understanding of God must be abandoned. I go to a monthly meeting about science and religion, and one time we had a local theologian. He'd written a book about how do you understand God in the scientific age. And he gave a description of his new understanding of God as a kind of a symbol of the unity of all of nature. And during the question period, someone said to him, well, what you're describing sounds an awful lot like atheism. And he said, well, I guess most people would say I'm an atheist. Now, consider the irony of this. This is a theologian, an ordained minister, who has come to the conclusion that in an age of science, the only reasonable response is to be an atheist. And I'm standing before you, a scientist, telling you nonsense. To insist on applying scientific methods for religious questions is just as inappropriate as trying to use religious scripture as scientific text. Some of the same scientists who point out, as they should, that the Bible is not a science book, fail to recognize that it is just as inappropriate to demand scientific methods of religion. Well, there are a lot of other things that I could say about science and religion, about the differences in the kinds of questions that science and religion ask. Science answers questions about how did things come to be the way they are? What was the sequence of events that led to our world, the organisms that populate our world being the way they are? Religion asks questions about what is the relationship between us and our Creator? What does God want for us? What does God expect for us? What should be the relationship between us and our fellow creatures? Now, these are very different kinds of questions, and they require different kinds of methods to answer those questions. Sometimes these questions overlap. I believe that the Bible teaches us that all of us our brothers and sisters. Science tells us that our DNA is all the same. That if we look in any human population, that we will find within that isolated human population 80% of all the genetic diversity that exists throughout the whole human family. Well, if that isn't evidence of the fact that we are all brothers and sisters, I don't know what is. So here is an instance where science reinforces the insights that have been given to us by religion. But by and large, science and religion are addressing different kinds of questions, and they're using different kinds of methods. But even the methods are sometimes not all that different. I was brought up in the Methodist Church, and I was taught that we are to have as the foundation of our religious understanding four pillars, sometimes called the Methodist Quadrilateral: Scripture, tradition, reason, and experience. Now, if you think about that, that's really not that much different from science. In science, we rely very much on received knowledge. We have our textbooks, we have the lectures of our professors, and that's an awful lot like scripture and tradition. Now, there's a difference. In science, we can do experiments and we can test the things that are told to us in our textbooks. Very often we don't, but we could in principle. So there is a difference. And reason and experience, that's what science is all about. Theory and experiment. So there's not all that much difference between the kinds of things that we use. We use our minds, we use the intellect that God has given us when we search the scriptures for understanding about religion. And so these areas, while they are certainly different, are not completely separate. I could also talk about how important the study of religion is to me in particular. And this may surprise you to say that when it comes to science and religion, I don't really think it's that important a topic. I don't expect when I have to face judgment that anybody's going to be asking me about my views on science and religion. I mean, after all, what does the prophet Micah say? What does the Lord require of you? But to do justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. So here's the message that I've got for you today. An ordinary scientist with ordinary faith is no anomaly. And I stress the ordinary part. As a scientist, I am not seen as some kind of a nutcase. I'm very conventional. As a person of faith, my beliefs are not much different from the others in my congregation or in the wider church. No weird or wild unorthodoxies. Ordinary faith, ordinary science. I don't bring any great insights on the relation of science and religion. I don't have some imaginative and compelling argument to convince the atheist to believe. What I bring is a simple witness. Ordinary faith and ordinary science are neither enemies nor strangers. Thank you very much.